Welcome to Influential Visions. Here, we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. My name is Nathaniel Schooler, and I am your host today. Well, it's great to be on a really interesting interview today. Actually, we're gonna talk about accelerated change within retail post COVID-19, and I'm joined by John Ashcroft. He's a specialist in economics, strategy, financial markets, and he's the creator of the Saturday Economist, NED consultant, advisor, and a chair. You've led over 50 corporate finance transactions, worked with First Boston, Bain & Co, Samuel Montague, Goldman Sachs, and others. And then I'm also joined by Eddie McAtominy. I'm hoping I get his name right this time. I've known him for 10 years. Did I get it right?
You did. You're very well done.
That's a relief. So Eddie's head of place crafting at BECG.com, and they're one of the largest environmental communication consultancies in the UK. Eddie's a highly experienced creative director of over 25 years of experience across retail and commercial, multi-channel brand and identity development. And also, I'm really, really pleased that Melissa Gonzalez joined me as well. And Melissa Gonzalez is the founder of the Lioness Group, an award-winning firm of experiential retail strategists and pop-up architects, and she's also principal and shareholder in global architecture firm MG2, and author of The Pop-Up Paradigm, which is building human connections in a digital age. So I'm really interested to kind of get stuck into this, because this is a really meaty conversation we're going to have here. Yeah. And you know, so much kind of going on. So thanks, guys, for joining me. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, good to be with you, Nat. Yeah.
So I think probably, you know, people are very concerned right now. We're going through something that no one really knows what on earth's happening. And there are all these people doing studies and all this sort of stuff at the moment. And I mean, everything's sort of changed. I mean, Melissa's over in New York, John's over in Manchester, Eddie's over in London, and I'm down in Chichester in Sussex. And, you know, it's quite strange, really, out there. And I think I'll probably start with the first question that I've got. I've got a few questions for everyone. I think for John, probably first. Do you think consumer purchasing behavior will return to what it was once we come out the other side of this, John?
Yeah, we're pretty confident it's going to return to some semblance of normality over the next sort of 2 to 3 quarters. I think we've seen some strange things happening. So the amount of payback on credit cards and domestic loans has been significant in the last month. So consumers are going to return with a pretty good balance sheet compared to the start of the episode, despite fears of the furloughing's been good, because, you know, there's very little to spend money on at the moment. So I think my Amex bills have dropped by about 60% since we've been in shutdown. And I think for a lot of consumers, there's a chance to do a little bit of balance sheet restoration. And they'll come out wanting to socialize and wanting to spend. And there'll be a return to normality much quicker than the doomsayers would have us believe.
Why do you think that they like to sort of sow these seeds of negativity?
I think it's a way of capturing the mood. So you had it during the recessions of, say, 2008, last time, and also in the 1989s. The news headlines are invariably about how many people have lost their jobs today in which sector. And in this series, we've had the number of deaths announced on a daily basis. Sadly, 5 people died somewhere in Wales yesterday. It seems to be what they want to talk about. So I started to do a very positive, upbeat thing about saying, you know, it's going to be moving out of lockdown by the end of May, or end of April. And People just wanted to hear something positive. You have to present a blue sky positivity. Yeah. And I got responses. So I had something like 500,000 hits on my LinkedIn posts over the last 3 or 4 weeks, which is quite amazing. Super. And people were saying, you know, Even my mum started listening to your or reading your posts because they're so positive and people want that positivity. So yeah, and it's yeah. What, listen to John Ashcroft if you want some hope, was the message. But I think that it's important, especially if you're in a business, that you present some blue sky, some way out of it, some realistic perspective about what's happening, but then try to explain that, you know, we're not going to be in lockdown for 2 years, or you're not going to be staying in your attic if you're over the age of 70, to get it in some proper perspective. So I don't know why they do it. They love to do it. But I saw a post the other day. It said, if you shut down all the media, then 80% of the world's problems would disappear. They certainly disappear from view, and you get a better chance of keeping it in perspective. I don't know why they do it. They do it. But I think there's a lot of reasons why there's going to be a very positive bounce back in a very short time frame.
Super. Well, that's really good to hear. I think, you know, Alistair Stewart, I had a good conversation with him a couple of weeks back, and he was, you know, we had a good old complain about the media. It was, yeah, a lot of fun, actually. It was a lot of fun. You probably don't know who he is, Melissa, but he's been on the news since I was born. You know, I mean, he covered the Berlin Wall coming down and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And yeah, we had a good conversation about that, you know, and then just asking these stupid, inane questions to the Prime Minister and the other people, which if they actually listened to the last answer, the question was answered in the first place, you know, and it's just quite shocking, really, that these people are allowed to actually have any airtime, really, you know, sowing the negative stuff, definitely. But So, I mean, I think everyone's quite probably going to be into this next question that I came up with. So what opportunities do you see within retail, John?
What opportunities in retail? Well, we've seen the big things that happened during the lockdown process is this doubling in the UK of online food sales. So it's quite a natural phenomenon, but generally we're expecting online penetration to be about 25% of total UK sales by the end of the year, or maybe in a year or so. But actually the big shift was what was happening in food, especially online. So now it's something like 30% of non-food transactions and petrol are actually online, which is creating a great hole in the high street. And it's a big hole to fix. And what we've seen with during lockdown is, as I say, online food sales have doubled. And that's a real structural shift that won't be replaced. So I think if consumers get in the habit, certainly in our household, of having those bulk deliveries delivered to the door — we live on the 16th floor of an apartment block — you actually get it delivered to the door, especially lugging it from your local supermarket. That's a big shift. So I think it is the big shift to support online. And the real problem's going to be, you know, you're going to see shrinkage of footprints for a lot of retailers that where I used to have a big footprint for a marketing support proposition. Now that no longer applies. You've got to really slam that footprint down. And they've got to become more event centres, not just the town centres, but even the stores themselves. So I think it's the same issues which apply, which have been accelerated, as your headline suggests, really.
Yeah.
They've accelerated the movement online. And the critical element of, you know, user journey, user experience, and Amazon sets them free. Amazon does set the standard there, that those are the benchmarks by which all will follow. And if you look at the in-store experience, you know, with social distancing, the rules on social distancing will have to be relaxed. The rules on quarantine equally will have to be relaxed, but you can't run a pub with 2 meter social distancing in the pub. And equally with a store where you're actually having to quarantine clothing samples for 3 days if anybody touches them. And even the chief executive of Waterstone was saying, you know, you're going to have to quarantine the books. If anybody touches a book, they're going to have to quarantine it for 24 hours before it can return back to the shelves. So all these extraordinary phenomena of in-store experience with social distancing, personal protection equipment, it's going to make for a weird experience. But it will happen, and the rules will be modified in quick sticks. At the moment, government have expended too much capital with Dominic Cummings and the relaxation of rules so far. So they're on the back foot as further relaxation measures occur at the moment. So yeah, so what will happen is an acceleration of what we've seen before, and some weird things happening in certain places, but I'm afraid online penetration is just the game.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Eddie and I were talking a while back about the kind of more of a localized kind of environment for people, weren't we, Eddie? Do you remember talking about that with me before all of this stuff happened?
Yeah, no, I think this idea of local, I mean, I live in a part of North London, I mean, you know, quite a sort of middle class part, but even prior to the lockdown, you could see the high street shrinking. I mean, the amount of charity shops, you know, in what is quite an upmarket sort of, you know, London village is staggering. You know, I would guess probably a third of the stores in our local precincts are effectively charity shops, and that's obviously down to not paying rates. You know, so there was quite a bit of retail shrinkage. And funny enough, there was a very high-end ladies' fashion store that had effectively three retail units. And as soon as we hit lockdown, they took the opportunity to do a moonlight flit. And this is selling very high-end women's clothes. So I think prior to, you know, the COVID outbreak, there was quite a lot of pressure in terms of, you know, rents and rates and parking and various other things that, you know, form that mix, which is, you know, create the negative on the high street. And obviously COVID's going to exacerbate that, I should say. So it'll be interesting, but I mean, I can see, I mean, there's a lot of chat about the advent of sort of experiential hybrids coming about, you know, which are sort of partly workspace, partly retail experience, you know, food and beverage and the like. And you can see that really happening. You're providing landlords are able to adapt, you know, rent, and local authorities are able to, you know, adapt rates and provide better sort of parking facilities locally. But I think this idea that, you know, I was a bit like, you know, John was saying earlier, I've been working from home for a couple of years. You know, I actually bloody hate it, to be quite frank. I much prefer to be in an office. I will be moving to an office once this gets over for at least part of the time. But I think, you know, there is going to be this opportunity, and I think a lot of businesses are considering, do they need to have, you know, centralized office space? You know, will people need to come in 5 days a week? Yeah, and I think if people aren't coming in 5 days a week, they are going to look beyond the sort of Starbucks Cafe Nero to have the sort of breakout times. And I think there is an opportunity to create something of a hybrid, which perhaps offers local meeting space. I mean, the big thing I miss in terms of obviously being on the creative side is a space to effectively brainstorm and meet people. Because, you know, creativity in a vacuum or on your own, you can only take it so far. And a lot of ideas come out of, you know, being as part of a group and the like. So I can see a lot of retail space providing, like I say, circumstances in terms of rental values and the like align, being considered for other part work, part commercial sort of uses. I think it's interesting times and could be very, very positive. And it is going to force an issue which was starting to happen around the digitization of retail. You know, that's really sort of moved it on massively, the whole COVID experience. So yeah, interesting times.
Very interesting. What do you think then, Mel?
I've been jotting down notes because John and Eddie have been sharing so much. I agree. I mean, we are getting pushed into technology adoption at a much faster rate. And I think a lot of the timelines that brands and retailers had to roll things out over the next 2 to 4 years are going to happen much sooner. We were kind of checking the box. Will consumers do X, Y, and Z? And that's what's kind of halted a lot of the implementation of technology, because brands and retailers trying to figure out the ROI around it and if consumers would do it. And we're seeing that they will. I agree, we're not going to go 100% online. I think they're, you know, maybe 20% makes sense. And it depends on the categories. I think it's interesting how brands and retailers will have to realign spend, cost structure. You know, when I look at food, especially here in the US, we're seeing prices continuing to hike while we've been in a pandemic. And so I'm wondering how that's all going to play out. And then just brands and retailers, I think of the cost of e-commerce, right? And of free returns and the logistics around it and just what are the overall effects going to be. But when it comes to the store, I definitely see it continuing to move in the direction of it being, you know, place of experience. If consumers know that it is that easy to click with a button, then we're going to need bigger incentives to get them to come to the store. I think we also are looking at how we're redesigning the footprint of the store to accommodate for a number of things. One would be if there is this rapid adoption of curbside and buy online, pick up in store and contactless payment, you know, we need to account for that customer journey. Those are more like quick serve metrics, right? Those are more about efficiency. And so if they're not logistically planned to be efficient, then we fail from a customer service point of view. But there are still going to be those that want to discover. So how do you have a store format that speaks to both? And then also, how do you have a more modular design that more fluidly flexes between front of house and back of house if we have to be able to accommodate those varying demands? So I think there's going to be a lot as we relook at. And then the third that we're looking at a lot is the purpose of the storefront itself and how does that become more flexible? You know, I look at Starbucks, for example, and a lot of them are looking at how do we redesign the window to be able to be more of that drive-through, that pickup experience, even if it's not a drive-through location. So there's a lot to really rethink. There's a lot of learnings this year. I don't think people are completely diving in when there's so many moving parts and so much to analyze about how consumers are really transforming, but you'll see a lot of changes come 2021.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think there's a lot of opportunity and you've nailed it there with, you know, that is where the opportunity lies, isn't it? It's sort of the difference between online and offline, but also the social distancing in the short term versus the sort of medium and then the longer term, right? But I've been giving a lot of thought to the future of jobs. And I think I want to hit John up with this one actually to start with, because I'm really interested. I'm talking to David Matheson later, who's the founder of the CDO Summit. I've got an interview with him later. And I'm really interested in the future of jobs. And I have a positive attitude about it as well. A few years ago, I used to be a bit negative about it and a bit worried, you know, about the robots coming and this and that. But I think we've got a lot of opportunity. Do you think there are some really great opportunities with new jobs coming along, John?
Well, I think there are. And I think it always has this fear of technological shift and how it would impact on the labour market, going back to the Luddites, or the Luddites actually was a food revolt, not necessarily a technological revolt, but that's one side. But there's been the history of challenge to new technology. And it's the same now with the concepts of particularly artificial intelligence and robotics. So I think you've got to look at, especially AI, as a very exciting phenomenon, really, because it's going to create a lot of opportunities in terms of data analysis and data prep and data mining and really working towards the improvements, as Mel was saying, about the user experience and the user journey through the ordering system. So I think we have done a lot of work on the impact of AI and technology on the job market. And there were fears in professional services about robotization or AI, machine learning in the legal sector or in the financial sector. But you can't get away, I think, as Eddie was saying, about the human touch that's so necessary for every form of interaction. So my personal saying used to be, you're never alone with 16 megabytes of RAM, was always my favorite. But the actual, the reality is there'll be lots of exciting opportunities because AI is such an intellectually stimulating phenomenon that to understand how that's going to roll through is quite exciting. Green technology. A lot of emphasis now on the green technology. I think we've all marveled at the low pollution that's been occurring in our cities, especially over the last 2 or 3 months. And the blue skies, you wonder in reality, those blue skies, they've not been touched by human distortion of heat transmissions into the stratosphere. So the green agenda's come much more to the fore. So I think in terms of AI, machine learning, new technologies, looking at the impact of the green push and the green technology, looking at developments in social care and caring for our older population, that's going to become quite important as well. So I think there's lots of areas. And I think also in terms of retail, the big emphasis, the big buzzword, especially in property, is on logistics. you know, it's how you get the product from A to B. And you can marvel at the fact that Amazon, such efficient, they are the benchmark boys for this kind of stuff. But suddenly, you know, drone technology, drone deliveries to the home doesn't seem as far-fetched now as it did even 3 months ago. So you can actually get, you know, in the 16th floor of a high-rise block in Manchester, a drone delivery to your balcony of your food requirements. It doesn't seem so far-fetched now. So I think there's lots of exciting areas to look at. AI, machine learning, the green agenda, social care, these kind of things are going to become so important.
I agree with you, John. As we've been working on store design with some of our clients that are really leaning into BOPIS and curbside.
Hold on. What does BOPIS mean again? I asked you this last time.
Buy online, pick up in store. I forget. I apologize.
She does this every time.
There's a number of acronyms, 3 and 5 letter. Buy online, pick up in store. Buy online, ship from store. You know, but we often, right, when we're looking at store design, we think of the customer journey. And in the past year, we started doing the package journey as a point of view, because it that is what has to be efficient to your stamp, you know, to what you said about logistics. We can't just think of the customer journey. We need to think of the package journey as well. And so we're kind of paralleling those mindsets as we dive into store design.
I think it's that question of integration as well, isn't it? Really, between front office, back office, between online and in-store. That, you know, I go back to sort of 6 years ago, 7 years ago, the question was, could you have dual pricing? Could you have one set of prices in-store, get another set of prices online? And people were grappling with that for quite some time. And in the same way now, this is not, and having separate stock for online, having separate stock for in-store, because the seasonality patterns were much more understandable and delivered in the business. So I think it's this full integration of the holistic approach to the whole consumer experience and the package journey, as you put it. That's a good point to make on the package journey. And I think that in itself becomes a real challenge for organizations of any size, big or small. In some ways, the bigger, the more complicated it is. Interesting that in the UK, Primark, for example, have really been suffering here because they've no online experience whatsoever. So they had zero revenues for 3 months and 1.8 billion of stock to explain what happened there. So, you know, compared to Boohoo, let's say, who've had relative success. So I think that, you know, you've got to look at this holistic experience in terms of the full integration of the several platforms on which you operate. So it's very important, but equally, I think it's a very exciting challenge.
Yeah, I agree.
I think what's very interesting, actually, is this what's come to the fore very much with COVID is the value placed on people. And, you know, it's certainly, I mean, probably in the US as well as the UK, the core value's been on quite low-earning people, you know, people who sort of care. And I think that whole thing, you know, if you look at that in terms of retail, there's been very high value placed on businesses' abilities to deliver, you know, so the likes of Amazon, you know, the fulfillment type businesses. But the key point of the fulfillment has been the guy who actually delivers. So even though he might be ringing your doorbell and standing away, that sort of person-to-person touch point has become ever more important in a time of lockdown. And I think it's quite interesting, because I think what it's actually done is it's sort of polarized retail to a degree, insofar as the two levels of great importance are at, you know, the level of the Amazon, but also at the level of the guy in the corner shop who kept going when Sainsbury's ran out of stock, which they did certainly in my local store. They ran out of toilet rolls and all the key things for a while, because the EPOS systems couldn't cope with the, you know, obviously surge in demand. And obviously it did adjust after a few weeks. But at that point, Sainsbury's or Waitrose or Tesco's couldn't cope. It was Mr. Ahmed down the road from us. As it happens, the guys down the road for us are actually Turkish, but they had queues around the block and they provided that service. And I think that idea of two levels of retail, where you've got the very localized becoming, you know, which has become ever more important, and people are using the very local, and then you've got these guys who can, you know, fulfill very efficiently, you know, via a click. I think it's actually polarized to two ends. And I think that this idea of creating local is going to come more to the fore, which, you know, probably John would say. I mean, what's again been interesting is this move towards cashless very quickly. You know, this idea of not using cash has been something that's obviously being pushed now because people don't want to handle cash, which obviously has implications in terms of economic implications, social implications, because cash tends to be at the lower end. I mean, I love cash, but the fact is, you know, in terms of people being paid cash, it tends to be lower paid workers, and cash is at that end of the market. And so I think there's a lot of things happening. You know, there's this advent of local and people wanting local, but in terms of local people, they're being sort of edged out because of the cashless. So I think there's a lot of things that are going to need to be addressed, and almost polar opposite forces happening in terms of, you know, overall retail, I suppose, which are really interesting, really interesting.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because, but in a way, it again echoes Mel's point about the acceleration of a fundamental trend. They've just been accelerated because of the lockdown experience. So cash is a classic example of that, really. We were seeing that phenomena moving forward, and then it's just whoosh in the last 2 or 3 months. And that creates opportunities. It creates problems for those who haven't got digital access in the main. And that has to be addressed. But that's an opportunity for the banking sector to look at.
Absolutely.
And some of the smaller banks can get into that place. So I think that is interesting. I rarely carry cash anyway. But I mean, that's been an acceleration of an existing trend. But the point you're making about retail and local retail is interesting. Because I think that, you know, in April in the UK, retail sales were down overall by 20%. But alcohol sales were up by 60%.
That is an essential business. So,
Food sales were up and alcohol sales were up. Everything else, and petrol included, everything else was bombed. Everything else bombed because the stores were shut. So, if you needed to go to the local to pick up your jerry cans of lager or your boxes of wine, then that was what was happening. But that's not going to move away from, you know, the fundamental challenges across the broader spectrum of retail. Absolutely. In terms of
it's interesting
as a designer.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I know as a designer, we always focus in terms of business. We always try to keep business in food, pharmacy, because there's certain areas that are always going to be there. Fashion isn't always going to be there necessarily. But food and pharmacy were the two areas we always focused around in terms of core, because we felt they're always going to be there at level. People can't do without them. Whereas fashion, obviously, goes up.
No, anyway, this is disappointing. I had you down as a fashion icon, mate. Yeah. What is that all about? I can't believe that.
Well, fashion for sure is definitely an industry.
Personal fashion, Eddie is an icon, yeah.
but I use a very niche, I go to a very niche. The guy's got one store in the UK and probably half a dozen in Japan. That's where I shop, And he's from the same part of the country as me, the north, so...
It was interesting talking about the logistics and the click and collect or whatever else you want to call it. Is listening to the chief exec of ASOS, they were saying in China, the model is to deliver the product and then wait at the door while the consumer tries on the article of clothing.
Okay.
And then
so it's like the services of BOPIS brought to you, kind of. They could take the return back right away if it's not a fit.
Exactly that, yeah. But it's quite interesting that, certain online retailers complaining about the returns and the level of returns and how expensive they are. Because I remember touching on the furniture business, and there, one of the problems in the furniture business was households buying sweets just before Christmas. So they get all the house looking nice for Christmas, and then when all the relatives have been, they shipped it all back in January. It's not really such a new problem or new phenomenon, but I think different ways of looking at it. People are getting blacklisted. If you over return, you get blacklisted by the online supplier.
But then you have other retailers who, when Zappos first, kind of pave the way, buy as many shoes and pick what you like and then send it back. And then everybody was trying to keep up and compete with that. It is an interesting challenge because you do have the bigger companies that can be trailblazers and they push the needle of innovation. Because they have the wallet too. And then it heightens expectations around consumers. And then how do the smaller brands and local businesses keep up with that? But I would say here in the US, it's been pretty interesting watching some of those smaller businesses get savvy on a low tech standpoint. Either they put a QR code on their window and they say, you know, that's how you could make our window shoppable. And they, you know, they can be pretty creative. Shopify has really put pedal to the metal and how they're going to help their network of merchants and build out a fulfillment network to further support them. And so I do think that there's a lot of initiatives to kind of try to level the playing field a little bit, even though there's a long way to go on that. But the other side that's interesting is that while there's budget for it with more of the mass retailers and brands to invest, there's also a lot of legacy platforms. There's also a lot of corporate structure to get through. There's a lot, takes a lot longer to make change. And a lot of the smaller guys, the smaller businesses, they have the advantage of being nimble and agile and making decisions on the fly if they want to. So for those who kind of do their research, I think some of the small businesses, the local business, have a good opportunity.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, I was thinking about the sort of nervousness in social contact and the way that that's going to sort of shape the recovery, Eddie. What do you sort of, what are your thoughts around that?
It's interesting. I did with a friend, we did a free, for want of a better word, idiot's guide to selling, which we published effectively for pubs, because I think it's quite interesting because, you know, most large pub owning businesses in the UK are effectively, you know, they all used to be breweries, you know, so breweries used to have an element of retail, which was pubs. And now you've got everyone from Japanese banks to whoever owning pubs, but effectively most of the larger pub owners are effectively landlords. You know, Weatherspoons probably aside, but again, Weatherspoons don't brew beer, they actually are a retailer. But what we found interesting was that the guys who are typically run a pub, so the publican or landlord or barman, whatever you want to call them, they're not really retailers, they're building managers. And pubs prior to this lockdown, you know, they open their doors at 11 o'clock and they close their doors at 11 at night, and people come in and buy the Carling, Carlsberg, whatever beer it is. It's not really a retail proposition. The retail proposition comes from head office, you know, i.e. they're given little packs that go on the back counter that form retail hotspots and have a, you know, the typical merchandising hierarchy in terms of product price and the rest of it. But the guys who are running them, they're not the old-fashioned set out your stall, yeah, make the products beautiful, attract people, shout, whatever. You know, they're not trying to attract people in the way the typical market stall retail started. So they're not really retailers. So we put together an idiot's guide so that these guys, because obviously every pub in the UK has large kegs of beer and beer has a shelf life. So you could see that by week six, the shelf life was starting to run out. They're sitting on all these kegs. Beer becomes poisonous. You're not allowed to pour it down the drains. So they then got the problem of getting 100 kilograms out of a cellar underneath a pub, which is normally 20 kilograms. But, you know, so we did this freebie. You know, it was about setting out your stall. It was about the idea you've got this big building. Use your building as a sign. You know, buy some sheets from Primark. Get some fabric pens. Write the message. Sell. You know, sell on a table outside in the street, put a mask on, be socially distanced, but offer takeaway, pour your beer into plastic milk containers and get rid of it. So like I said, we put together this idiot's guide to retail for pubs and we posted it and we gave it for free. And obviously we gave it for free as a sort of marketing ploy for ourselves in the future to be seen as the good guys who did this for free and offered up this sort of service.
Shocking. That's shocking.
But the companies that owned these 1,000 pubs weren't providing that information to them. For them, it was easier just to close the door. But our view was a pub is a fundamental part of the community. And COVID has been the perfect chance to create that sort of touch point with your local community. And as it happens, my pub down the road, which is called the Maid of Muswell, I live in a place called Muswell Hill, was refurbished, and the refurbishment finished just at the point of lockdown. So there's this beautiful brand new pub with a beautiful beer garden, beautifully painted, that's just remained completely static, lights off, during the whole of this campaign. If I walk up the road to Highgate Village, all the guys who own the pubs are outside with tables at the weekend. They've got wine, they've brought in local breads, they've used their kitchens to make things, and they're selling, and they're keeping themselves part of the community.
Important. I think it's important. Yeah, I'm in Hoboken, so right across the water, and we've had some that where you see the importance of storefront and the design of that now, those that have like the garage door opening or the accordion windows and all of that. Now that the weather's gotten warmer, they're all open. They have music playing. They're letting kind of pop in shops in their windows. So restaurant I love, it's a Mexican restaurant, Orle. They have, their window, and they're serving margaritas and all of that. But then they've offered their other windows for pop-up coffee shops and other F&B vendors. And if you do it right, it's a perfect example where, you could still get that passerby. I was walking by with my husband because we were going for a walk, and I wasn't going out looking for a margarita, but the vibe felt so good. It felt so nice to feel that again, and the music, and get to talk to your bartender, and we walked away with drinks. And, so I do think that you have to keep that human side of it, because people still want it. They got that impulse purchase from me without hesitation.
I must have missed that ruling where the ruling where pubs are allowed to open in Muswell Hill. When did that appear?
Well, they're going to
take a drive
not
over.
As such.
When you call them touch points when you call them touch points in the local community, that was in clear breach of social distancing guidelines as well, actually.
Touch points at a distance, obviously.
But I think I've got one question, right, that all of us, right, should think about, because I've got so many questions. We could do another three of these and talk forever, right? But I think this
is there a greater being? Is that one?
No, it's not that question. But the digital transformation, right, has happened so quickly. It's been crazy. Yeah? Like in the UK, they seem to think, I was listening to some data the other day, and they seem to think that I think it was 2 years worth of digital transformation has happened in like the space of 2 months. Like that's how crazy things have been, right? But in that context, what excites you guys the most about the future of retail? I think I'm going to ask Melissa first.
I am excited that there's validation that this integration of technology in the in-store experience is necessary. I've been a proponent of it in a lot of ways. RFID, which has taken forever to move forward for many reasons. But the ecosystem around technology has been so fragmented, right? There's hardware suppliers, there's third-party resellers, and you need a software platform. There's so many elements of it that made it difficult to integrate. And I think now that we're seeing there is a clear appetite for consumers to use it, you're seeing accelerated adoption. I think that ecosystem is starting to come together more, and they're starting to realize, hey, we have to work together. And I think that it makes the in-store experience, it's going to be elevated. And so as somebody who sits in that, that's an exciting part for me to be able to now integrate some of these ideas that we've been talking about for years and years and years and be able to see them come to fruition.
Who's next?
I'll go.
I vote for Eddie.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, all right. Cheers, John. It's funny. I was reading something about this, and this is not my terminology, but I thought it was actually very good. And basically what they said was retail is about four things. So it's about recruitment, finding a customer, transaction, selling them something, fulfillment, getting it to them, and then retention, you know, making them come back or engaging them. And the reality is, I think the perception of online sales is and has been for a long time, people think it's much bigger than it actually is. Because I think if you ask someone on the street, how big is online retail? They all think it's 95%, and they think that's why the high street's dying. I think it's created this sort of mask that has stopped the actual real problems being addressed. And the real problems are things like the level of rates, the fact that local authorities charge a fortune to park, certainly in, you know, most of the city centres in the UK. So, you know, that's the thing. But retail in terms of physical retail is still huge. You know, it's still a huge percentage. It's still the much larger percentage. You know, 75% is effectively through a store. But this idea of recruitment, transaction, fulfillment, retention, the space is about the retention and recruitment side. So it's about, you know, effectively the finding the customers and you know, making them come back. And I think, you know, as long as it continues to do that, it's still going to be very important. You know, that idea of that's an experiential thing, and the recruitment retention is the thing that the experience is about, you know, finding customers and giving this experience that makes them want to come back. The other elements are, you know, the digital thing really is about process. And if you know, to me, if that process makes it more efficient, it frees people up to do the thing that people do, which is interact with each other. Yeah, so I mean, I know that digital also can provide some of the experiential, but I think it, in some ways it can be a great thing, because all of that messy stuff is going to be taken away by digital, and it'll allow people to interact with each other and set out the stall and, yeah, give the experience around the product they're actually trying to sell. So I think it's a great thing, but I think it's got to be handled properly. And I think the whole experiential thing could be absolutely phenomenal if it's done right. And things like, you know, the prosumerism, the idea of, you know, companies like Maid, where they're producing furniture to order. I think a lot of businesses are going to be able to open up, you know, locally and provide digitally printed elements and this, that, and the other, which can form the whole experience. And you're going to find completely new things on the high street in 10 years' time, which are around technology, but will add value to people's lives.
Thanks.
That's it. That's all I've got to say.
What do you think, John?
Well, I think it's going to be tough. Because I'm glad Eddie said what he did, actually, because I have two natural biases in my persona. One is an optimism bias, and the other is a contrarian bias. So I was always brought up to challenge. So I don't agree with some of the things that Eddie said there. Because I think that from I can't believe I've been sitting here for 50 minutes and not disagree with somebody. But so,
thanks, John.
From the point of view of online, you cannot escape the fact that, excluding food for the moment, that one in three transactions for any retail sector on average have gone online. So that means you're losing 30% plus of your business revenue. And if you've got, you know, you're operating on a 40% margin, let's say, and you're losing 10 or 15% plus to rent and rates, and another chunk goes in staff costs, you cannot cope with that kind of loss of market share effectively. So you're losing one in three transactions without having to radically shrink your footprint in the high street, which is what we've seen. So I think the continuing challenges will continue at pace for all of the retail sector. But there are a lot of opportunities, I think, as Eddie was saying, in terms of experience shopping, and Mel was talking about experiential shopping in the high street and elsewhere and in the local communities. And also the thrill of integration of online, offline, this focus on the package journey as opposed to the people journey. So I think it's going to be tough. Retail is going to be tough. And I think that, going back to your original point, the consumers will return. And you know, when in Manchester, when we had the unfortunate experience of the terrorist attack, there was a period when people stayed away from restaurants and pubs and stayed away from the centre. But quite quickly, they overcome the natural concerns and return to the normality. And I think we'll see that with COVID. And I think with social distancing, I think one of the Met police was saying, you know, it's going to be difficult to keep social distancing in the pub once they've all had a couple of pints. And I think that the social distancing rules will drift away because of nature itself. And also, it's just absurd that, you know, the restaurant trade, hotel trade, the pubs, they cannot survive with a 30% density in the place of operation. So, yeah, so I think retail will be tough, but the exciting thing is this full integration and developing the experience. But it's going to be a hard grind for a lot of retailers.
I think it's going to be hard, but you've mentioned rents a couple times now. And I think the other side of it is how real estate is going to evolve and how they're going to work differently with brands and retailers in the future as well. That's going to be an important element as we look the way license agreements or lease agreements are structured. You know, it's not 100% the same as how it is done in the US, but there's definitely a lot of conversation around that. And, you know, landlords, they can't squeeze the brand so much that they don't have an opportunity to ever be profitable. Nobody's going to win in that situation.
I think
maybe we should focus on property in another session someday.
I would love to do that.
It's a whole other topic, for sure.
There are so many things that we can talk about.
Landlords with compassion should be your theme for that session.
That's a good one, right? I think the opportunity for more houses and retrofitting office buildings as well is going to be big, yeah? Because, you know, with the shrinkage of these physical locations, there's going to be more houses available. That's how I'm looking at it. I think it's going to feed a bit of a boom, really, in retrofitting, is my personal opinion. I've been thinking about that.
It's interesting, actually. One of the planning uses that was always sort of really decried here was this. You got it on the riverside on the Thames when it first sort of started to be developed from the old warehousing. You'd get the live workspaces, you know, where they created this sort of studios ground floor, and then you effectively lived above it. And you can see that model really easily working on the high street. In actual fact, there's a road beside me. When my kids were at the sort of primary school at the bottom of the road, some of the parents got together and forced this road to close because people were using it as a rat run to get to the North Silla Road. And it had a small parade of shops on it. And if you walk up there now, all of these shops are residential because effectively, you know, the parade couldn't operate. They put a barrier across the road. But you could see in local high streets, the idea of creating these sort of live workspaces. And I would love to live in a shop or a pub or, you know, I noticed there's an estate agent called the Modern House or something. And they've got a butcher's, you know, with the old tiles up for residential use. Wow. So I think the idea of mixing it, as you're saying, that, you know, combining work and retail and residential, you know, much more mixed than it typically is now, could be really interesting. But again, it needs a mind shift from local authorities and planning, you know, landlords. I mean, you know, we're talking about landlords. I mean, obviously one of the issues in the UK is the fact that so many pensions are tied into property in retail terms. You know, and I'm sure that's something John could speak a lot on, but, you know, it does require more than just a mind shift in terms of rental values. There's a whole raft of other underlying social issues because of the way money works in terms of property in the UK. Yeah, I don't know how.
For sure. And same thing in the US. It's like, it's not just an easy change. It's a whole other episode, like John said, that we could probably go into. Yeah. But it's the way in which REITs are structured. It's the way in which deals are structured. It's the lending is structured. I mean, there's so many elements that you have to work through in order to make real change. Another episode.
Thanks, guys. It's been really super. I've really enjoyed it. And I'll speak to you soon.
Cheers, Nat.
Okay, nice to be with you all.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in, everyone.
Yeah, cheers, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections too. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thank you.